Part 1. Home. No one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark. You only run for the border when you see the whole city running as well. Your neighbors running faster than you, breath bloody in their throats. The boy you went to school with who kissed you dizzy behind the old tin factory is holding a gun bigger than his body. You only leave home when home won't let you stay. Picture a refugee camp in Thessaloniki, Greece. You can't? I couldn't either before I spent 10 days there volunteering with SAMS, the Syrian American Medical Society, which is an organization that provides medical care for refugees. There are about 50 to 60,000 refugees in Greece alone. The three camps that I worked in, which were some of the better ones, housed only a few thousand. The Greek government and military have done their best to provide safe and livable spaces for refugees. The camps are located in abandoned warehouses in remote areas, and each refugee family gets a tent about 10 by 10 feet in size. Everything they own is in that tent. There's water and three military-prepared meals a day. Some camps even have a school for the children. The people are free to leave the camp, but without a car and without money, there's very little they can do. The people are strong, some of the most resilient I've met in my life. Capable of crossing countries under attack and threat, carrying small children through long miles and dangerous boat rides, people that have seen more and done more than most will see or do in a lifetime. And now, they're in Greece, so close to the end, and everyone is forced to simply wait. But before the war, and before all of this, most people in Syria were happy.
Then the way of living there, I lived it was really amazing because we were living in a neighborhood like with a lot of people, and we were always like kind of kids. Like actually, there were more than 100 kids. We were always like a lot of kids and a lot of friends. We are just going there to entertain, not to fight for something. What are going? Then that was really cool.
Meet Abdul Aziz. He's an 18-year-old boy from Homs, Syria, who currently lives in the refugee camps in Greece. He has a bright smile, a contagious laugh, and is an absolutely brilliant artist. Let me explain how I met Abdul Aziz. He was working as a translator for SAMS, the Syrian American Medical Society. But he wasn't introduced to me as simply a translator. Countless people had told me beforehand that there was a boy I had to meet who was a brilliant photographer and talented digital artist. He ran his own Facebook page called Through Refugee Eyes, which had over 2,000 likes. But more on that later.
It's a wonderful city because like the way of living there, I didn't see it. I left a lot and I lived in a lot of places. And until now, I'm just like 18 and I really lived in a lot of places. And I'm going to see more and more for sure. But I didn't see something like Homs.
Abdul Aziz has lived in a lot of different places in his short 18 years. When he was 12, he changed schools 4 times in Syria. But not for the reasons you think. He changed schools because of a girl.
I was really like good in the school and I was like the best student. When I left all the like the teachers, why? Because for 2 years I was really in a lot of troubles. And yeah, there were three. And in the beginning one of them he's in love with this girl. There's like, what's that? You're in love with her, that's not my problem. Then that was really bad because in a lot of time they were like kind of fighting. Then I left from that school. And I've gone to another school. And in this second school it was good.
Unfortunately, his reasons for moving after that weren't quite so innocent and funny. The war began in 2011 when the dictatorial government of Bashar al-Assad fired into a peaceful protest. As the protest continued, they started to become violent and a group broke off from the military to form the Free Syrian Army. Civil war had officially broken out in Syria. Since then, the war has only escalated, and the civilian population has been stuck between the regime, rebel groups, and extremists facing attacks, chemical weaponry, and mass executions. Hundreds of thousands of Syrians have died in the country, and millions more have been forced to leave their homes. The attacks still continue.
This is the worst thing, actually, to feel like you're a refugee from your beginning. For me, it was like the revolution. It was started when I was like in middle school. When I was feeling free a little bit, like I just moved to another school, it's in the city. I was going there, I have a lot of friends there, we were going around, we were like, We did like kind of football team. We did a lot of thing in that year, the same year. Then the war started. Then our school, it was one of the school, like, it was nothing from the beginning. They just arrested a lot of, like, students because we just were and we just supported the revolution.
Many towns in Syria experienced this same transition from bustling metropolis to mass grave. Just like Abdulaziz, Nasreen watched her home and city crumble in front of her eyes. Nasreen is a pseudonym. She did not want me to use her audio or her real name, but gave me permission to tell her story. Here is Wynne Howard reading her story.
I am from Qamishli, a beautiful touristy city even bigger than Damascus. My husband's job is in homes, where we lived with our family. We had two houses near Damascus, an apartment in Qamishli, and one in homes. We were very well off. We had a car, and my husband was employed at a tile company. I was a teacher for students first through sixth grade. When the crisis started, the whole town of Homs was destroyed. The area we were in was very heavily militarized. We prayed for the bombing to stop for 5 minutes so we could sleep. It never did. The military would sometimes fight within itself. It was especially terrifying when dissenters tried to leave. The military's snipers would shoot them. We would hide away from the windows to avoid being shot. We would even refuse to go to the refrigerator to get food because it was near a window. Outside, people would cry and scream, but we were too scared to open the door, so we would have to listen to the screams for help. The next day, we would open our doors, and there would be dead bodies everywhere. The military would sometimes come clean them up. But we got used to it. The kids would play outside, even with bullets whizzing by. At the beginning, we would send the kids to school, but we stopped after a while. In order to get to school, the school bus would have to pass through military checkpoints and have their bags searched for bombs. The kids had witnessed people being shot at the checkpoints, and during school, they would hear bombs dropping and see smoke. The children had nightmares so bad that we had to stop sending them. One day, the military came to town and did a search of every house. They said if anyone looked at them, they would be hit with a rifle. They took half the men away, anyone who was Arab Sunni. The military would ask everyone to take out IDs and money and everything else in your pockets. They would take your money and phone and use the ID to know if you were Kurd, Arab, or Christian. Had it not been for God, we would have been dead too. One day, they did a raid on my husband's company and took 15 men and put them in the trunks of cars. There was one man who I liked a lot and was very overweight. He did not look like he would fit into the car, but they pushed him in and drove away. The wives of missing men would come into town every day trying to find their husbands. We all knew that their husbands were dead, but we didn't want to break the news to them. We decided we had to tell them so that they could try to find the bodies. One day, I got a phone call to evacuate the city. We had half an hour. They told everyone if they found us, we would be killed in front of our spouse and children. We did not pack anything. We just ran.
Just like Nasreen, millions of other Syrians began to leave and sought help from the rest of the world. This call to action resonated with people like Lara Zakaria, who's a pharmacist and nutritionist and has volunteered on two missions with SAMS to Jordan.
This is such a huge humanitarian need. It transcends all that is, culture, religion, ethnicity, anything. I think as humans, we like to compartmentalize things and we like to keep things nice, neat, and ordered. But there's no way to really order this because this isn't just about refugees. This isn't just about the crisis within Syria. People like to call it a civil war. People like to call it a conflict. They like to call it refugee crisis. But it's really all of the above. And there's so many different areas that we have to focus on and look at all simultaneously that it's very hard, I think, for us to really wrap our head around.
Part 2, The Journey Begins. No one leaves home unless home chases you. fire under feet, hot blood in your belly. It's not something you ever thought of doing until the blade burnt threats into your neck. And even then, you carried the anthem under your breath, only tearing up your passport in an airport toilet, sobbing as each mouthful of paper made it clear that you would not be going back.
We didn't make this war. We didn't make it. It was by its own. And until now, we really feel bad. It's impossible. Now you are here, but if you know that you will not go back to your country, what you will feel? You will feel really bad. You can't see your home again, you can't see your stuff again, you can't see your friends, you can't see anything. You're starting your new life. And that's what's happening with us.
The countryside they lived in was in a constant battle between the government and the people, the ownership switching sides on what seemed like a weekly basis. Eventually, his family had enough. They had moved 6 times through the countryside trying to avoid the war, but it seemed to be following them. Abdulaziz was not able to go to school, and his family felt that this was not the way they wanted him to live. They left for Turkey in the hopes of a brighter future.
When we have gone to Turkey, it was really normal. We were going to go illegal because they are taking the passport and sometimes making some problem. But we said we will try, and we were going by passport. Then it was good, because we have just gone by passport. But after our leaving in Turkey, 1 month, it stopped. The way to come, it stopped. And even that, if you are going illegal, like Turkey, like military, or Turkey, the police or the military in the border, they have order to kill anyone can cross the border. And in the last time, there were 37 victims because of that.
But in Turkey, he faced a new and unexpected challenge, racism.
Then that was the new thing, and it was the worst thing we faced it. If you will be killed because of government, it's better than be in that thing, or to feel inferior, like to feel there is someone like telling you that, this is not your country, so you can't stay here, or you can't even that stand in this place because this is my place. Then what? Yeah, it's okay. Maybe that you're right. This is your place, yeah. But remember, one day you will have the same thing. There is someone will tell you that's not your fucking place and you will just leave from there.
Abdulaziz's brother was working in Turkey throughout this time. He was running a small mobile phone shop. One day, the government came into his shop and took all the phones because they said they were illegally obtained. They weren't. His brother had to start again.
It's like a game. We are really living in a game. Go in a level, then fall down, then start again from the beginning. Then go, fall down, start from the beginning. That's it.
Abdulaziz takes powerful photos in the camps to detail what daily life is like for refugees and has created photo campaigns in the past. He runs a Facebook page entitled Through Refugee Eyes, and has had photography exhibitions in multiple countries, aided by volunteers who have met him and been thoroughly impressed by his work. He's admired by many, including Maddie Williamson, the field coordinator for one of the mission trips to Greece. She spent 11 weeks there, from April to the end of June. Maddie met Abdulaziz while he was in Echo Camp, an informal camp in Greece, which we'll talk more about in a bit.
He's wicked smart, and his whole family's like that. When we were in Echo, his mom would feed us every night. She'd make enough food for, like, all of the volunteers to come and eat, and I would have iftar with them. They're wonderful people. I always try to, I guess, humanize it because we're always like, oh, well, there's 56,000 Syrian refugees trapped in Greece, and it's just totally different when you put a name and a story to it. And then on top of that, like, even that can be too overwhelming for people where they're like, well, clearly we don't have anything in common because they're fleeing a war zone, and here I am with my life. But with his family, it's like that they have the exact same values as my family, where if there's guests, you cook for them, and you make them sit down and eat and feel welcome, and you enjoy each other's company and give each other gifts and hugs and share tea and that kind of thing. I love telling people about that because I think it that's a piece of something that they can identify with, whereas, like, living in a tent in the parking lot of a gas station after fleeing wars, too much for some people to comprehend, but saying like, oh, we have a guest, let's feed them. That's something that I think all of us can relate to.
Part 3, The Boat Ride. You have to understand that no one puts their children in a boat unless the water is safer than the land. No one burns their palms under trains, beneath carriages. No one spends days and nights in the gallbladder of a truck, feeding on newspaper unless the miles traveled means something more than the journey. No one crawls under fences. No one wants to be beaten, pitied. Meet Zainab. She's 12 years old and currently lives in the refugee camps in Greece with her mother and two younger siblings. Zainab's story was translated to me by Dr. Noor Akras, a pediatrician from Chicago, who I was lucky enough to meet on this trip to Greece. Her family was smuggled out of Syria when the war began, and they stayed in Turkey for a couple months, but her father left a few months before them, the hope being that the rest of the family would be able to join soon after. This is the case for many families in Greece. The fathers are somewhere in Europe, and the rest of the families are waiting to be reunited. Zainab and her mother and two younger siblings plan to leave Turkey to meet up with their father. He told them not to take too much with them, as the journey would be long and difficult. Her mother bought about 750 liras, which is the Turkish currency, worth of small cookies in case her younger brothers got hungry along the way. They walked for about 5 hours, and there was a lot of barbed wire to cross over. When her mother was climbing down this cliff in order to get to the rafts, she had to climb over the wire, and she asked the smuggler if he could hold the bag of cookies. He was so angry that she had brought them that he threw their only possession over the cliff. They had no food and nothing to their name. Finally, they reached the point where they'd be waiting for the raft. They were a big group, about 100 people. And when the raft finally came, about 70 people got on. Zainab's mother was too scared. She felt that it was too crowded and the raft would sink. So they spent the night in the woods with no food, trying to stay awake and watch for the Turkish police. Finally, in the middle of the night, the raft came. The ride over was pretty safe, except for in the middle where everyone got scared and they had to throw their luggage overboard. They reached Greece after about 3 hours and were immediately ushered into camps where they met with Doctors Without Borders. Just like Zainab's, Abdulaziz's journey had similar perils.
45 people running overboard. When you are in the middle of the sea, you're just looking at the moon. There is nothing at all. No voice. All the people really like, they are afraid. No voice around you, nothing. You are just listening to, you know, to the machine. The same machine, like, working. You are just listening and you are afraid to stop. Because if it will stop, you will die. It's a long time. You are counting every second of this time. Because when you are late, actually, when I just put my, like, my foot in the rubber boat, I felt really strange. Now, I don't have myself. I can't do anything. Now, I'm not in the land. When we left, just like, we were looking at the light, like, beside us from Turkey. You are looking at Greece and it's really so long distance. We're just leaving.
Nazreen's travel was a little different. She was quite well off in Syria.
We were still in Turkey with my sister borrowing money. I borrowed 1,000 euros and found a smuggler. We had to leave the house and go to the border of Turkey to meet the smuggler. He took our money the first day and put us in a hotel and left us there for 4 days. Other people who came after us were leaving to go to Greece, but he was not taking us. They had paid him more money, so he had taken them first. On the fourth day, we told him to either take us or give us our money back. He had promised us a speedboat and had shown us a picture of a boat we would get. When he brought the boat, it was a small boat with holes in it. We said no way. Finally, he brought a small speedboat. It was not as nice as the one in the picture, but it would do. We had brought life jackets, but the smuggler gave them to other people. Fortunately, it was only a half an hour ride. When we arrived in Greece, we discovered that the border had closed just a few days before. If the smuggler had taken us on the first day, we would have been in Germany right now. We reached the island of Samos first. I was so happy my dimples showed again.
Part 4, The Camps. No one chooses refugee camps or strip searches where your body is left aching, or prison, because prison is safer than a city of fire, and one prison guard in the night is better than 14 men who look like your father. No one could take it, no one could stomach it, no one's skin would be tough enough. After finally reaching Greece, Nazreen was so excited that her journey was over.
Finally, we thought it was the end of our troubles. We were going to head to Germany, and I was so excited to see my husband again. We rented a hotel room for the night. We showered and washed our clothes and boarded a train to Thessaloniki. From there, we hailed a taxi, and with our money running low, we spent 100 euros on our cab ride. It was a long ride, and we were weary. But halfway through our journey, the police pulled us over and said that refugees cannot take a cab to the camp. They must walk. So we walked 2 hours in the rain. We finally reached camp, cold and tired and wet. There were tents being handed out, but we were not one of the lucky ones. We were told the NGOs would be coming the next day to hand out tents, but we could not wait. We brought a small camping tent for 50 euros, and we all slept, one on top of the other, cuddled tight for warmth. The next morning, we woke up covered in dew. The NGOs had arrived and gave us a big tent with blankets, and every couple of days they brought food. We were so humiliated. Every day, we would tell ourselves the border will open tomorrow. We spent 5 months worth of tomorrows. We are still waiting.
When people first reach Greece, they're taken to informal camps like Echo and Idomeni, where they are registered and wait for the next step. Many volunteers flocked to Greece when they learned that the camps were being set up for refugees. Maddie Williamson, who spent 11 weeks in Greece, describes her first encounter with Idomeni.
I think the highest it reached, they estimate, it was like 25,000 people stuck there in these fields, like pitching small camping tents in the mud. The rain and wind conditions in early spring were horrible. The sanitation was awful because they had not anticipated this massive number of people actually setting up a permanent spot there. And the clinics, most of the healthcare providers there, except Doctors Without Borders, early on were providing care out of the back of mobile clinics or out of a small tent setup. We would have people with fungal infections in their feet because you could never get anything to dry. There were really bad upper respiratory infections because everything was just soggy and cold and wet all the time. And the kids had constant colds, and people were kind of burning whatever they could find. So it was incredibly grim. That was one of the most shocking, earth-shattering moments of my entire life, was walking through Idomeni for the first time and seeing not just the conditions, but the scale of it was unbelievable.
Like many others who landed on the shores of Greece, Abdulaziz had a hard couple of weeks moving into the informal camps.
In all my staying here, I was in the line for food and for that stuff maybe 5 times or something. We are not used to do that. We are getting our food, yeah, but we can work and we can get our food by our hand. We are not used to get our food from another people. We are making us wait in a line or something to get our food. For one time, it was raining for 2 days. We just drowned in the water. All of the tent, it was like all of it water, the stuff, the things. And they have a lot of precious things, like my hard disk, I got it from Turkey, all of my stuff in it. I have one blanket under me. I have to sleep in it. And then I was the first time going to the blanket disputing, waiting with more than 200 people to get one blanket. A lot of fighting, like, oh, my blanket. Then I was there for maybe like more than 1 hour or something getting blanket. Then I just came back from there, and they have gone to another line for soup because I was hungry after so long day. I got like a soup, and I was walking under the raining, and it was really like, we have nothing.
As more and more refugees moved in, the government began moving people from these large informal camps to a more settled formal camp. Dr. Afsana Safa, or Afi for short, witnessed this transition firsthand during her work as medical coordinator for SAMS in early May.
They weren't allowed to cook. They were given food, which, you know, didn't look particularly palatable or and wasn't the kind of food that they wanted to eat. Although potentially I think there were a number of, the ratio of toilets to people might have been a bit higher, the quality still was just as poor. In many of the camps, they didn't have beds. The mosquitoes, where these formal camps were situated, were kind of, you know, in the middle of nowhere. I mean, even our sat nav struggled to find them. Some of them were situated near sewage plants, and you could smell them, you know. And one of them didn't have any running water. They had a big tanker, and when the water ran out, it ran out.
Afi said that when people moved into the formal camps, it was like hope was knocked out of them. Because the camps were more rigid and fixed, people knew that they were going to be there for much longer.
And often, you know, refugees were saying things like they wanted to go back to Syria even. They'd rather be killed in a bomb blast than, and this is the word they used, than die slow death in Europe, which was really powerful words and true and very, very difficult to witness, knowing that they had come to Europe and this is what they were experiencing.
Now, after like 150 days, 150 nights and every day, we have nothing. We are the best people of waiting. We are still waiting. 6 months now, and there's nothing happened. Still, in the same game, the same players, new players coming and some players leaving, but we are still the goal. 6 months.
Galia is a Kurd from Aleppo and has 9 children. When I met with her, she spent a long time telling me about each of her children. One son is in Germany. Another was murdered 15 years ago at a wedding. Another was in the military and was taken to prison, but when they cleared out the prison, he was not found. The rest of their children are with her. Her husband was diagnosed with cancer 2 years ago and is also with her in the camp. She prays for his recovery every day. And she hopes that her son in the prison is missing and not dead. She agreed to do this piece because her hope is that if he hears her voice on the radio, he'll get in contact with her. Dr. Noor Akras translated for Galia.
After all these problems started, we all became refugees, and everybody's in a different area. We were humiliated, and this is how it is now.
What's the biggest thing that she needs right now in the camps?
Yeah. The thing that she needs most is that this situation ends and that God ends the situation for them, because really it's made them all ill. Said, look outside. We cook on the fire out there. It's dirty. We're all sick. The kids are sick. Our nerves can't handle it anymore.
Her son in Germany sends half his salary every month or two, about 150 to 200 euros, and they use it to try and get along.
She said that the Greek were very hospitable. They were so nice to them, and they welcomed them. And then, you know, then they went, they got to Edemini, and then they kept thinking, like, okay, today they're going to leave, or tomorrow they're going to leave. And that's how it's been, today, tomorrow, and they haven't been able to leave. We're a big family. There's 8 of them. It's not like one or two people. I don't know when God will make this situation easier or better. I just don't know.
Galia describes her day-to-day life in the camp.
So they wake up around 8:30 once the sun's like hitting down on them. It beats down on them, so it kind of wakes them up. Then her husband rings the breakfast. She sits out here for a little bit, has a cup of coffee. And then they, like, clean up the tent. They get some water. And, you know, the kids wake up and stuff. We do our laundry. So we have to soak, because the laundry's all on our hand, like, we have to soak the laundry first, and then we wash it. Then the sun will have moved out of the way a little bit, so then we bathe the kids. We cook, but around the sunset time, whenever that is, all the mosquitoes come out, so right away we come back into the tents, so otherwise we will get bit by the mosquitoes. And the next day is the same thing. Every day is the same. There's no place to go, so it's all the same. Every day is the same.
I asked what the food was like.
So for breakfast, they get a croissant and a box of juice. And a peach. For lunch, they had like lentils with rice. It's like a Syrian dish, or maybe a Greek dish too. She said they didn't like it, so they didn't take it. So for dinner, they haven't brought anything yet. She thinks for dinner it might be boiled potatoes. Tomorrow will be macaroni. Sometimes they give them green beans, sometimes green peas. And then they start all over again. She's going to make like a traditional Syrian salad with has little like fried bread on it. That's what they're going to eat today. She said that we don't really depend on the food that they pass out because it doesn't taste good. Twice a week they bring them meat. So once it's chicken and once it's beef. But when they bring the meat, they clean it up and they like cook it again just to be sure, and then they eat it to be sure like it doesn't make them sick. And there's an NGO today that passed out bananas just for the kids. So they got four because they have four kids. Oh, every other day it comes. So they used to pass out oranges, but then they found like there was bugs in them. So then they stopped. They stopped doing the oranges, and now they were passing out peaches.
Over the course of our interview, I asked her multiple times, in various ways, what can be done to improve daily living, and she gave me the same answer every time.
They're not like greedy, like they're wanting things, you know. They just want to eat and drink, and not to be dependent on anybody else.
Part 5, Trying to Adjust. The go-home blacks, refugees, dirty immigrants, asylum seekers, sucking our country dry, niggers with their hands out, they smell strange, savage, messed up their own country and now they want to mess ours up. How do the words, the dirty looks roll off your backs? Maybe it's because the blow is softer than a limb torn off, or the words more tender than 14 men between your legs, or the insults easier to swallow than rubble, than bone, than your child's body in pieces. I want to go home. But home is the mouth of a shark. Home is the barrel of a gun, and no one would leave home unless home chased you to the shore, unless home told you to quicken your legs, leave your clothes behind, crawl through the desert, wade through the oceans, drown, save, be hungry, beg, forget pride. Your survival is more important. Survival was the goal in the camps. It was something that Dr. Sam Song saw a lot of in her time as an OBGYN with the Syrian American Medical Society on trips to both Jordan and Greece. She speaks about two women she met who opened her eyes for very different reasons.
I have a really good story. It actually was at this government camp. So a patient came in for completely, you know, something like vaginitis. And I had made it a point to bring condoms, you know, to try to decrease the pregnancy rate. So in this dire situation, so I made sure I brought condoms and that I spoke about birth control pills, and we did have birth control pills there. So after we took care of the vaginitis issue, I said to her, I said, do you need birth control? And she's like, birth control. And she's like, what's that? I said, you know, so that you don't get pregnant. And she looked at me and she said, you have that? I said, yeah, I have that. I can help you. You know, I can give you 3 months and then you can come back if you're still here. And she told my interpreter this. She says to my interpreter, it was like the skies opened up and the heaven came to her because I offered her contraception. She was so happy. She was one of those women that kissed me many times. And then I said, well, and I also have condoms too. And she said, you have condoms? Oh my God, you keep giving me kids. But she was so happy that she said, I've never been offered contraception, and yes, I want to take contraception. Actually, it did make our day.
other women's stories were slightly different.
I had this one conversation with a young lady, you know, who was newly married. It seemed like they married young there. And I said, well, why would you want to get pregnant in this situation? And her answer to me, she kind of put me in my place in this regard. She said, I don't know how long I'm going to be here. I could be here for years. And if I don't get pregnant, you know, my husband will be very disappointed in me. And we have to still continue our family. Our grandparents have died. My uncle was killed. She had many people in her family who had died. She said, we still have to continue to live, even in the situation. I was like, okay.
Whatever the reason, it was clear that people in the camps were trying to do more than just survive. They wanted to live. There were soccer matches played. People would collect around the main courtyard and watch the young men play. They'd pick sides and root cheerfully for their team. Lara Zakaria worked as a pharmacist in the camps in Jordan, which were much larger and more established than ones in Greece. But she noticed in Jordan as well, the same thing. People always found a way to survive.
Kids like running around in the street and, you know, playing football, soccer. There was a lot more life and joy than I expected to see, which was a huge relief. And it was actually very heartening to see how resilient the people were and how resilient the kids were and how happy they were to see us. And, you know, there was a little strip that they set up shop. So they have bike shop and, you know, a little clothing store and even like a lingerie store. There was life. And just to show kind of how Syrian sense of humor is, they called that strip the Champs-Élysées. And they were very proud of that name, of the ironic name that they had chosen. But it just kind of goes to show that, like, kind of life goes on.
The camps in Greece are becoming more established as the months go by and people try to make the best of things. In one camp, the refugees set up a panel of elders to represent them and communicate their needs to humanitarian aid groups. The first thing they asked for? A school for the children. Working as field coordinator, Maddie tried her best to facilitate the community relations that were slowly forming at some camps.
Someone brought their espresso machine from Idomeni. People were bringing their hot plates. So there was like a cooking area. There was a community cooking area in the front, you know, the outlets. And then in back there had cooking fires and all the women could do their thing together and spend time together. And there was a class. Well, it wasn't really a classroom. It was just like a space on the back of the loading dock that had some mats and all the kids could go back and do classes together, that kind of thing. So I think just setting up some sort of routine is huge for people. It's like, okay, well, we're going to sleep in because it's really hot and then get up and make our coffee and then go sit with the barber and chat about life. And then once it's cooler, then we can pull out the speakers and dance, and all the kids are going to run around and play football and that kind of thing. The first week or so of moving in and settling in is kind of tricky. Everyone's just really frazzled and trying to just get situated generally and get used to the flow of things. But once they established that rhythm and schedule, it was really great to see everybody sort of come together again, and everyone started cooking together again and playing soccer together again, and somebody brought speakers, and so all the men were doing dabka together, and that was really great.
Eventually, people were able to settle into the new military camps, but the beginning was not easy. Maddie said that for her, one of the worst experiences was just driving to these new camps. She had to take long, winding dirt roads filled with potholes, driving past abandoned buildings while she slowly realized how far away these people were living from the rest of civilization. Maddie said that while she's sure there were reasons for putting them so far off, to her it felt like they were just being swept under the rug, put places that no one would want to go, let alone live.
And it was also cripplingly hot. I think that week it was over 100, maybe 5 days out of the 7. And then it didn't cool down at night. The mosquitoes were horrendous. There weren't enough toilets. They were running out of water by 2 o'clock in the afternoon because it was so hot. The food was terrible, that kind of thing. But within a few weeks, sort of the community identified, like, okay, well, here's this guy. He speaks really good English. He's really good at communicating. He's well-respected. He can go and speak on our behalf to the military or to the police, and things can start to look up. That was when there was a bit more of a boost. But my concern is that, especially in this location where there's that feeling of permanence to it, I'm really concerned that that is going to plateau within the next month or so as it starts to cool down and people kind of realize, like, we're going to be here for a while.
Everyone seems to appreciate the volunteers and what the Greek government and military have provided. But the sadness and anger after being in these camps for 6 months is apparent.
We're coming from a strike country. You destroyed your country, now you're coming to destroy our country. And for sure, that's not our goal. We are here because of you. You destroyed our country, not we. You sent the guns for that. You just shut your mouth up when your government was sending guns for that. Why you didn't speak to them? This is not our fault. That's your fault. You just burned the fire, and the fire started there, and it's continued to be here. And it will continue to be in your mouth, the same mouth speaking about that, repeating that on us. Refugee, destroying your country, coming to destroy our country. Yeah, we are really like, forgive, yeah. But sometimes you have limited energy to forgive. If you don't want to help us, don't help us. One day, you will be in the same. We will not give you our hand. You will be alone. After 6 years of war, we are losing in every year, in every day, or in every hours, a lot of people there. No one care. We hope so we're going to be in our country. We're not happy here. We're not happy there. We're not happy in all the Europe. Even that we are in the paradise of the world, we will not be happy.
I've been advising a lot. Try to avoid anger. And now it's very easy for me to be sitting on my couch here in Ireland and telling Abdulaziz, don't be angry, you know, and don't be frustrated and keep hope and et cetera, et cetera. But at the end of the day, it's very difficult.
This is Dr. Wael Barrow. He's a physician from Ireland, born and raised in Lebanon, capable of bringing both Eastern and Western perspectives into his thoughts and actions. He's great friends with many in the camps, and it's clear that he cares deeply for Abdulaziz.
There might be hundreds of papers there. So eventually, Abdulaziz is going to move somewhere. I have no doubt. His family will get relocated somewhere. The question is when. And with Abdulaziz, it's the time factor that I feel the burden. So I could imagine how difficult for him. Because every day passes, he's kind of losing it a bit more of his ambition and his positivity. Now, he is stronger than we think. I mean, he's trying now to focus on other projects. He had time to work on his pictures. I'm not hopeless for him. I know he will get relocated somewhere. I'm just trying to keep an eye on him and keep encouraging him and stay positive and avoid anger and politics. Once he goes that road, it's a bit risky and turbulent.
Living in the camps is difficult psychologically, and Abdulaziz is not the only young person being negatively impacted by life in the camps.
My name is Simav Hussein.
And you're 15?
Yes.
Simav is a Kurdish girl who lived in Aleppo for most of her life. She lives in the camps with 3 younger siblings and her mother, who's an artist and fashion designer.
I born in Syria, in Afrin. After it, we moved. To Aleppo, and I was there like 11 years. I went to school, everything. And when it's war, we came back to our town, and it wasn't safe. It's like Aleppo.
When you left, was that when a lot of people were leaving? Or
yes, there are lots of people leaving from Syria.
Oh yeah.
Some of them died in Syria, like my cousin. This is our life in Syria.
Simav's father took 8,000 euro and traveled from Turkey to Italy. When the war got especially bad, her mother took her and her 3 siblings to Turkey. From there, they traveled by sea to Greece. It took them 4 tries because they kept getting caught by the Turkish military. Finally, they made it to Greece.
I don't know, it's very difficult. And then we came to Greece, and from Greece to Idomeni. In Idomeni was like 3 months. in Idomeni. And then we came here, and we are here 2 months, and we tried 2 times to go to Macedonia, and they catch us, and it's very difficult.
So when you guys tried to get to Macedonia, how many people were it?
Just 100 people.
100 people, and you guys all just walked together?
Yes.
How far a walk is that?
3 days, 4 days.
How far did you make it before they...
4 days.
You were pretty much
yes.
there. So you got all the way across the border
yes.
into Macedonia, and then what happened there?
They just catch us.
And how did they bring you back here?
They put us in the car, and they put us on the border to Greece, and they said go, and don't come back again.
Many people have tried to walk out of northern Greece into Fyrom, which stands for the former Yugoslavic Republic of Macedonia. There's a regional debate over what constitutes Macedonia, but the point is, leaving the refugee camp once in Greece is not easy.
Some of them have money, they're trying. Some of them don't have money like me. I'm staying here.
How much money do you need to leave?
A lot of money, a lot.
What's the next big change, you think?
Nothing. I think we're gonna stay here for years and nobody asks for us. There are people helping us, but it's not enough. We don't want to help. We want to go from here. Go out. Be free. I didn't see my dad since 1 year and 5 months. My mom, she's a fashion designer.
Has your mom talked to you about what she wants for the future?
Yes, she wants to put us in safe place. That's all she wants. And we go to school and university.
What do you want to study?
Engineer plane.
Really? That's so cool. What got you interested in that?
I don't know. Because I was dreaming if sometimes I get the plane.
Simav makes a swooping gesture with her hand, up and out. She dreams of having a plane and flying away.
Ultimately, what they need is you putting them in your luggage or on your back and getting them where they want to go. And there are many, many people. You hold their hand, you squeeze their hand, say, I'm sorry. Deeply on behalf of everyone, but we are trying to help you. There are people helping. We didn't forget about you. And for the time being, this is the only thing I could give you, some painkillers for your muscular pain. But it doesn't work for you, the pain that you really have, you being stuck here.
Part 6, Searching for the End. No one leaves home until home is a sweaty voice in your ear saying, leave. Run away from me now. I don't know what I've become, but I know that anywhere is safer than here.
I'm quite optimistic. It sounds like an old man talking.
Wael reflected on his journey home after the first mission trip he took. It was back in September, long before the camps were well established. It was chaos and despair. He felt guilty about abandoning the people he had met and the friends he had made by simply being able to get on a plane. Even more ironic, his flight home was from Greece to Germany.
Of all the connecting flights I had was Greece to Germany, and that was the promised land, that was the promised route. It took me 2 hours while it used to take them 6 days of pain and misery.
He felt emotional returning. But he came home positive, having met others that wanted to help as well. And having met refugees that restored his faith that maybe there could be an end to all this. He tells the story of Sobhai. Sobhai was a man that Wael met on his first trip to Greece, to the island of Lesbos. He was a very well-educated man with a young son, and because of his language skills, he'd been chosen as a leader of a group trying to migrate from Greece to Germany. Sobhai kept on meeting people and picking them up along the way, so he ended up with a crowd of 18 when Wael met him. They kept in contact through the months. Sobhai would call Wael occasionally from different numbers in different countries, and Wael would try and help him out.
I was lucky to meet him. He's such a nice man and a lovely human. And luckily, I had some friends who could help him along the way when he got from Mytilene to Athens. Just someone helping finding a hotel to stay overnight and book a ticket, train ticket for him so he doesn't travel with 18 people trying to speak to Greek people about train ticket. This is before they closed the borders. And then he would call me from time to time with different numbers, or he would disappear for days. And then eventually, he made it to Germany.
That was the last Wael heard from him. He would think about Sobhai and his son from time to time, wonder how they were doing, if they were alive. Until very recently, when he got a voicemail.
And then on Sunday, I got this lovely voice message via WhatsApp from him for 5 minutes, first reminding me of himself as if I ever forgot him. We talked that afternoon, and he asked me if I accept that he sends me a copy of the local newspaper with an article that he wrote in German, and there's another article about his son. So this guy settled really well in a small village in Bavaria. He started learning German. You know, they give him a bit of money for financial support, but he's been actively trying to improve his German and, you know, trying to study. So he's mastering the language. Within 6 months, he managed to write an article in the paper about his experience. And on the other hand, his son, his eldest son, he's quite a good footballer. So a local academy saw him, spotted him, and they were so happy with him. So they recruited him to start playing for the local area team. So they also put an article about him in the paper. And like I was tearing up because this is what you want. This is what they wanted as well. They just want that normal life. I'm trying now to tell every person that I still know stuck in the camps in Greece, saying, this is Sobhai. This is you a few months ago. Don't lose hope, please.
Sobhai was asked by his German neighbors to cook Syrian food for a festival in the area. The food was a huge success. The day before Abdulaziz and I spoke, he learned that his family had officially been accepted into Spain. He'd be leaving the camp finally. He doesn't know exactly when he'll be leaving, but there is an end in sight. Although he will get to leave soon, there are many other people and many other families that will not. For Zainab, the 12-year-old girl we met earlier, all she wants is to continue her education.
So when she was in Echo Camp, she met a volunteer from Germany, and that lady taught her how to count from 1 to 10 in German, and she learned some words.
That's awesome. Can I hear it?
Neun, eins, zwei, drei, vier, fünf, sechs, sieben, acht, neun, zehn.
That's awesome.
And then she taught the lady how to count from 1 to 10 in Arabic. She's so upset that from the time she left Syria until now that she hasn't been able to study, that she hasn't been going to school.
What do you want to do when you grow up?
Doctor. Inshallah.
Thank you to everyone who made this piece possible, the Syrian American Medical Society, and all of the wonderful people that I met through that. All of the people that agreed to interview with me, and the brilliant minds at WWFM. Special thanks to Peter Fretwell, Rachel Katz, and Wynn Howard for helping me to make this possible, and to my mom for inspiring me to make this piece. The poem read throughout this piece was Home by Warsan Shire, and the music used was Arthur Rubinstein covering Chopin's Nocturne Opus 72, No. 1 in E minor. This program was produced at the studios of WWFM, the Classical Network.